Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Keith Krueger, and today we're very fortunate to be joined by Robert Ovitz, a lecturer in political science and public administration, who writes about the politics of the labor movement, work, and the crisis of capitalism at the turn of the 20th century. Professor Ovitz has appeared on NPR, BBC, and CNN, and his articles published internationally. He's the author of the recent book, When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921, and editor and contributor to the 2021 publication from Pluto Press entitled Workers' Inquiry and Global Class Struggle, Strategies, Tactics, Objectives. Professor Ovitz, Robert, thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Keith. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Thanks, Robert. Hey, let's start with some personal context. How did you come to the study of labor, and who were your scholarly influences along the way?
Well, I think I came to study labor as a teenager pondering a story that my father had told me. He was an immigrant to the United States. He grew up during World War II and was incarcerated in a labor camp by the fascists in Hungary, Romania. After he had left after World War II, he was working on ships, and he told me a story about how some of his fellow sailors, he worked in an engine room, were planning on going on strike. And he didn't want to go on strike with them, and they beat him up. And I pondered that for years. Like, why would my father not go on strike? And I never did get an answer, but it got me thinking about labor very early on. And when I was in college, I attempted to form two labor unions. One by myself at a food co-op that failed miserably. My girlfriend at the time was on the board, and that kind of blew up our relationship. And the second time was as a graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin. I was part of a larger group, and we weren't the first ones to try. But being Texas at the time, it was incredibly difficult, and we weren't able to really get it up off the ground. So I kind of came to the issue of labor from my own personal experiences. And later on, while I was in college, I started reading a lot of Marx. And I found somebody by the name of Harry Cleaver, who was in a different department, and started taking his classes. And I ended up taking every one of his classes, even some of his graduate classes as an undergrad. And I studied with him also in grad school, although I was in a different department. We're still friends, but I really found that Marx gave me an analytical framework to understand the world, particularly capitalism, I should say. And it got me thinking about class conflict and class struggle as a driving force in the change of policy and law and systems of government. And it made a very strong impact on me. And so that was really kind of the the genesis of how I came to studying labor.
Did that change your final PhD focus in the end?
It didn't change it, because when I decided to stay on at the University of Texas at Austin, I like to say I was institutionalized there for 11 years. I did my undergrad, my master's, and my PhD there. And when I went to grad school, I already knew what I wanted to do. And I wrote both my master's thesis and my dissertation about the reorganization of higher education into a corporation, to a profit-making business. And I used the University of Texas, which was probably a suicide pact for my academic career, as my case study. And so I focused on how student movements in the 60s through the 80s had led to a reorganization of higher education.
In your latest book, you talk about organizing as part of the California, I guess it's with the CFA, you're part of that group. So that all comes, is a natural progression for you, really.
Yes, that's well said. Yeah, it's a natural progression. And I took a break from academia. After I got my PhD, I moved to the Netherlands and I lived there for 6 years and tried to become a sound artist and a performing musician. And I started working for NGOs. And so when I came back to the United States, I thought, what can I do? And one of the things I started doing was teaching. I'm essentially a full-time adjunct. And I realized, oh my God, I've come full circle. I was writing about the neoliberal restructuring of higher education in grad school, and now I'm living it as one of the 70%+ faculty who are not on the tenure track.
And that's not an easy track, as you say. And I've seen how even, who is it? I guess Patrick Cunningham. Well, there's a few people actually who use the word precarious.
Yes.
And so it's an existence. And I saw also in your first book, you wrote in your introduction about that it's hard to really do the kind of research and have the kind of focus that you want and need to bring to bear, and then at the same time be juggling a bunch of classes running from one campus to another.
Yeah, thank you for acknowledging that. I did have a lengthy passage in my introduction in my first book explaining why it took me so long to write my first book. In addition to trying to figure out what I wanted to write a book about, I also discovered teaching in academia, I was at community colleges for the most part, and the library resources there are in some ways worse than in a high school, and the databases aren't very broad, and so I couldn't really do a lot of research. And it wasn't until I got hired by James Martell at San Francisco State that I first really had access to a university research library and research librarians who could help me track down obscure books and documents. And a whole world had reopened for me. And it made a huge difference. You know, in addition to teaching at 2, 3, 4 campuses at a time, sometimes 6, 7, 8 classes at a time, it makes the production of academic knowledge very, very difficult. And so it's no accident that many faculty today, like myself, do not even publish or go to conferences, academic conferences, or involved in journals or writing or appearing in the media because we're too busy teaching multiple places.
Thanks for sharing that. Well, let's work back to that because you cover your experiences in chapter 4. I think it is about basically credible strike threats when you were on the staff there at San Jose, or I guess you still are at San Jose State. But I wanted to, before we get there, when Workers Shot Back was the first book, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. Brill published it in 2018, hardback. And then came out in paperback with Haymarket Books the following year. Now, that's part of the historical materialism book series, and you mentioned your interest in Marx. Can you tell us about the series and the significance of the publisher's name?
Sure. Well, the Historical Materialism series is connected to the Historical Materialism Conference, which really began in London at SOAS, in one of the predominant universities there. And it's now have some spin-offs before the pandemic. I think it was in three or four other countries. So it's a conference that has many different elements, different approaches to Marxism. And they have, along with the conference, they have a journal by the same name, also published by Brill, and they have the book series. And the book series has been going on, I think, almost two decades. I may be wrong about that. And they have dozens and dozens and dozens of books. I think they put out probably about a dozen a year. As part of publishing with them, your book is in hardback, published by Brill, very, very expensive academic publisher, great publisher. It's been around for like 500 years or something like that in the Netherlands. And then after a year, Haymarket republishes it exactly the same way. So, you know, they're always looking for people who want to publish their first book or their 20th book if it's related to Marxism, and just a fantastic group to work with.
What, was there a connection with Brill and you being in the Netherlands at one point?
No, actually, I had never heard of Brill until I had moved back to the United States. And it's kind of funny, but I actually worked for a competitor while I lived in the Netherlands as a freelance editor. I worked for Kluwer for their law book. Division. So it was kind of ironic, but sure. No, I wasn't aware of them then.
Well, speaking, I guess the idea with the book series, I guess we could stay with that for a second. Your latest book, Workers' Inquiry, is also part of a series, Wildcat, Workers' Movements and Global Capitalism. Can you tell listeners a bit about the series and the editors? Pluto Books figures prominently across the reference sections, I noticed. They're not a nonprofit organization. Hey, what's their mission?
I'm new to Pluto. I've read some of their books over the decades, but Pluto came out of the militant movements of the 60s. I can't speak to the internal organization or their mission, but sure. It's a great publisher that's been putting out just amazing books that I've, you know, come across going back to being an undergrad, scouring the library shelves. But they have been involved in publishing books dealing with almost any social movement, militant movement, workers' movement over the last half century. They just turned 50, I think, last year. And so I have been friends with Emmanuel Ness, who is a well-known militant labor scholar. Most recently did a pretty influential book called Choke Points with Jake Wilson, and about the global supply chain and worker organizing. And he had asked me to guest edit an issue of a journal that he had. It's called the Journal of Labor and Society, which I'm now involved in as the book review editor. And I curated a series of articles about global workers' movements. And he said, hey, why don't you put it together as a book proposal and pitch it to me, because I edit the Wildcat series for Pluto. And so he showed me how to do a book proposal, and has really kind of taken me under his wing, and he got Pluto to approve it, and it came out last October.
Wow, that's great. Thanks for sharing that. Before we dive into the books, hey, I wanted to ask you, you wrote an article a few months back, published in the San Jose Mercury News, that was titled America's First Attempted Coup also tracks to January 6th or to Jan 6th. It was published just a month after what George Packer described in The Atlantic as a mob of freedom-loving Americans taking back their constitutional rights by shitting on the floors of Congress and hunting down elected representatives. Can you tell us about the Newburg conspiracy, America's first attempted coup in 1783, and how you described it?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me about that, Keith. It's actually going to be part of my next book with Pluto that I'm actually writing right now, which is a class analysis of the U.S. Constitution. It's going to be a smaller book, much smaller, and it'll be kind of an introduction for people who want to understand the kind of things that George Packer's talking about. Why is the United States on such a rapid decline? Why can't we address any fundamental pressing problems? For example, the Senate couldn't pass an election reform bill yesterday because of what is being called a filibuster, although I don't actually think anybody filibustered. And so as part of my research, I came across another January 6th at the end of the American Revolution. The Congress, the Confederate Congress under the Articles of Confederation, and the states had run out of money. And there had been an effort to they couldn't pay the soldiers anymore. And there had been an effort of some of the officers, as well as some of the enlisted men, to cut a deal where they wouldn't get paid now, but they'd get a lifetime pension. They're at while they were at Newburgh, New York, kind of waiting for what, you know, whether they would go home or they would have to stay ready for whatever was next. There was a plot that was hatched really by Alexander Hamilton and Knox and Gouverneur Morris and James Madison, and to try to use the dissatisfaction and upheaval of the soldiers not getting paid to try to encourage them to essentially carry out an assault on Congress, and to at least to threaten Congress with an assault in order to force the Congress to pass funding to pay the officers for their lifetime pensions. It never came to that. There was some rumbling among the officers. There was a letter that went around that threatened to do something vague like that. And then Washington got wind of it. And to his credit, he called a meeting on the day that the anonymous flyer had told everybody to gather together, presumably to come together in a forced march on the Congress, which is far away, but nonetheless. And Washington kind of got the upper hand. This is where most historians leave out the rest of the story, but this is where Washington famously got up in front of his soldiers and presumed to have pulled out a letter from his jacket, and he couldn't read it. So he said, you know, I'm sorry, the years of war have been long and hard on my eyes. And he pulls out his spectacles and puts them on and reads this letter asking the soldiers to have faith in Congress. And then famously, you know, according to the propaganda, the soldiers cried, and that was the end of the coup attempt. Well, months later, Hamilton writes several letters to Washington where he pretty much bears all and admits that he was involved in this plot. And so I called that the first January 6th, although it never went as far as what actually happened this year. There was an attempt to try to do an end around and try to install presumably Washington, although he didn't go along with it as a military dictator.
Yeah, well, you end the piece by basically saying that, hey, look, at the seditious plotters both inside and outside of government are not punished. They will live to try again. This is a lesson we must learn from our own January 6th coup attempt. But knowing what you know now, I mean, and I'm referring to how the Senate Republicans blocked the creation of an independent probe, and now House Speaker Pelosi's indication that she might create a new committee to investigate this insurrection. Hey, what are your thoughts about the utility of this kind of partisanship?
Well, I think we live in a dangerous time. We just had a president who, with what he did in the last few months in office, you know, was preceded by 4 years and previously as a candidate several times, where he was essentially praising dictators and shunting traditional allies. We live in a very dangerous time. There are a lot of indicators for that. I think the George Packard piece and the Davis piece in the Rolling Stone make it very clear that America is in a rapid decline. And when a country's in such a long decline, there are always interest groups that are looking to kind of pin responsibility on one group or another. And we've seen that, for example, with the demonization and incarceration of immigrants. I mean, we have a series of concentration camps for immigrants, which is horrifying, pinning it on people of color, on service workers, you know, with recent claims by Democrats and Republicans that, you know, unemployment benefits are too generous and people are too lazy to work for poverty level wages. And the examples are on and on. Our system essentially is dysfunctional and broken because that's the way the framers designed it. They designed it to be an anti-democratic system that allows a small minority, numerical minority, not a racial or ethnic minority, to block change that they don't want. And now we're living the circumstances of it 2 centuries plus later, where no change is possible. And people across the country are dissatisfied with the system. And many people are susceptible to blaming one another and thus being susceptible to fascist ideas. And so the number of neo-fascists and fascist groups in America are on a rapid rise. Apparently ammunition is flying off the shelves. Gun sales are flying off the shelves. Mass shootings are escalating as fast as the temperature is rising on our planet. I think we're in a very dangerous time, as dangerous as when the Nuber conspiracy was being hatched.
Thanks, Robert. Well, speaking of partisanship from a different perspective, you point out in the introduction of your first book, and again, When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921, although it's a much studied period of violent class conflict, it's actually not well known by many people and usually described from a moralizing or documenting perspective, and less so on situating the self-organization of workers within class struggle and existing class composition. You divide the book into three main parts. Part one covers the 1877 railroad strike. Part two on the 1894 railroad strike. And finally, part three is titled more broadly, The Revolt of the Rank and File. The first two parts cover over half the book, and though they're similarly structured around your class focus, for instance, part one includes working class recomposition in the 1877 strike in chapter two, and chapter three about capital's new composition. And then you reapply this lens in the 1894 strike in chapters five and six. Can you unpack the meaning and the significance of class composition and recomposition in terms of their explanatory power in these violent episodes of U.S. labor history?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, the reason why I decided to write that book was for the same reason of what you just asked me with the previous question is, you know, what is the situation that we face today? We seem to be at a position where there's intense class conflict that's bubbling just below the surface. Wealth inequality is massive. Corporations have grown gargantuan. And much of the population is working too much for too little. Things are broken down. And it doesn't seem that normal politics works anymore. I've been thinking this for quite a while. And a little over a decade ago, I was teaching a class on terrorism, the politics of terrorism. And I started thinking about, I started coming across this strike that happened in 1877. And I started reading everything I could find about it. And I realized that what we call terrorism today is not a new phenomenon. In fact, the class conflicts that emerged during what is called the Gilded Era was also denounced as terrorism. I wanted to find out why and what kind of lessons can we learn from that period of the beginnings of industrialization in the United States and the consolidation of truly wealthy elite and the shift from agriculture to industry and from a rural population to an urban population. What are the lessons today? Because I wanted to see how does change get made when the system seems locked and change is even basic, modest reform is impossible. What can make change possible? And what I discovered was the biggest period that we refer to as a period of change, the New Deal period, was not preceded just by the Depression and the strikes in the early 30s. but was actually preceded by the previous six decades of class conflict. And the 1877 strike was the period where I wanted to start, and I wanted to end just after World War I, because I wanted to demonstrate that the greatest change happens not before class conflict breaks out. It doesn't facilitate class conflict, but it actually does the opposite. It manages it, it controls it, it disciplines it. I think reform is only possible when class conflict erupts. And the response is reformers that are working inside the system then translate what's happening outside in the streets and on the shop floor into reforms that they otherwise can't get done. And so I needed to figure out a way to explain that. I'm not a historian, so this book is, even though it's 600 pages long, not to scare people away, but I wasn't breaking new historical ground, but I wanted to do an analysis of why did these strikes happen, first of all? Why were they characterized by so much violence? And then how did they actually precede change? And so I used the theoretical constructs that I learned from Harry Cleaver, who I told you about earlier, mm-hmm. and Marx. And I used what I call class composition theory. Class composition theory essentially is a three-stage process for understanding how change occurs. So first is understanding that employers, what I call capital, responds to previous waves of class conflict by reorganizing itself. It restructures what I call the technical composition. So it reorganizes production by introducing new technology, new division of labor, rationalizes labor, it outsources, it automates, and so forth, right? It eliminates certain kinds of employment and creates new kinds of employment. So workers who had been successful in the previous wave of struggle now find themselves decomposed. They find that their previous power has been essentially suppressed by this new strategy of capital, of managing the capitalist economy, managing even at the firm level. So how do these workers figure that out? They have to study the technical composition of capital by using what I call workers' inquiry. They have to understand work and how work is organized and how they are fragmented and isolated from one another. And by understanding that, they can then go into the third step, which is to recompose their power, to respond to and take the offensive, if you will, to counter the exploitation and oppression that exists in the workplace and in capitalist society as a whole. So I think of it as a three-step dance. It's kind of like a spiral. So when capital changes its technical composition, workers' power is decomposed. When the workers recompose their power, capital responds by introducing a new technical composition. So if any of you have read Marx, you know that the three volumes of Capital are essentially a snapshot. This is capitalism in the middle of the 1800s as he studied it in England, right? So that his book is essentially a snapshot of the class composition process. So what I did was I looked at these big events over this five-decade period, and I wanted to see first, why did workers end up resorting to armed and violent forms of tactics? What led them to escalate their tactics from peaceful petitions and grievances to, in some cases, armed militias of workers engaged in self-defense? And then how the employers responded and so forth. And then how did that also contribute to changes? A change in the technical composition of capital. How was capitalism reorganized to respond to that? And then how did workers respond in kind? And then also how did the state change its involvement in the capitalist economy? And one of the things that I found in this time period is that the idea of state intervention in the capitalist economy really begins at this time period. And just to kind of wrap up this, my answer to your current question is, this is the period when the populists and the progressives come to form, to prominence. So you get these reformers who start looking at the class conflict and say, here's some reforms that we could introduce, change the way that the economy operates by intervening and then bring about these changes in reforms. So the book is kind of lengthy because I think that there's a lot going on that preceded the New Deal that actually kind of laid the groundwork for what we celebrate during the Great Depression.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Clearly, the book, all 600-plus pages of it, not a short read, but a good read. And it's not an endorsement of violence or simply just another description with attribution to psychological or theological or ideological causes. Hey, do you think, as you overlaid your, in a sense, class composition theory on that period, do you feel like when we talk about the terminology like labor and capital, do we need to redefine those things? Is that helpful?
Well, I'm glad that you saw that continuum. So where I was looking at a historical period in the United States to see how change occurs and how conflict follows this kind of tactical trajectory, and then the state and capital respond, I then shifted and wanted to look at it today globally. My answer to you is no, we really don't, because fundamentally, even though the types of work change, the tasks that we do, the way that corporations operate, the relationship between what we call the private sector and the public sector, although I think they're not really as separate as we talk about them, I think all of that still fundamentally operates the same. The details are different. The system is still pretty much the same.
Sure. So context, again, is everything. In the conclusion, you quote from the late political sociologist Barrington Moore Jr.'s article, Thoughts on Violence and Democracy, and I quote, "It's untrue that violence settles nothing. It would be closer to the mark to assert that violence has settled all historical issues so far, and most of them in the wrong way."
Yeah.
As you know, one of Moore's graduate students was Charles Tilly, who figures prominently in your book's bibliography. You utilized Tilly's facilitation curve, which you refer to as IOMO in chapters 2 and 7, and in the lead up to the conclusion when writing about the West Virginia Mine War and the Redneck Army in chapter 10. Can you tell us about the significance of scholars like Moore and Tilly and what IMO IOMO stands for and why it's relevant to your analysis.
Tilly is really an incredible sociologist. He was not a Marxist, but he understood class conflict in a really interesting way. He was the originator of what is still a dominant school of sociological thought called resource mobilization theory. And what Tilly did was he studied revolutions, particularly the French Revolution. And he also studied the Paris Communes and various other periods of turmoil in French, recent French history. And he wanted to try to understand the role of violence and conflict in a capitalist society. And he developed essentially what I would say is a kind of coda for how to understand when social movements take up violence as a tactic. He talked about it as a tactical repertoire. And I have several different objectives with that first book. And I talked about using class composition theory and workers' inquiry and understanding how reform happens. But the third objective of the book is to try to understand when struggles become violent. How does violence enter in as a tactic? Now, we've made a lot of mistakes in understanding political violence in the last few decades. Particularly after 9/11, this whole kind of global cottage industry of consultants and theorists and academics, military thinkers, have mistakenly confused violence as an objective, or even as a morality or a philosophy or even a theology. What they've forgotten is the lesson that Tilly taught us, and that is that violence is a tactic, and movements do not begin with violence. They actually end with violence. They either end because they're repressed, or they destroy themselves, or they de-escalate and become political parties like the FARC in Colombia, for example. And so what Tilly did was he identified what he calls interests, organization, mobilization, opportunity, IOMO. And he created this kind of logical coda by which we can understand how movements go through their repertoire and they try different tactics until some work. And the response can be that they are repressed or they win some of their concessions. So they either disappear or they de-escalate or they become institutionalized or they fail and they develop new allies and they become stronger. And so they escalate their tactics. And at every point along the way, these different outcomes can occur. And sometimes they even become governments like Israel. We shouldn't forget that it was terrorist groups that became the first government in Israel. In fact, I have some relatives who are now deceased that were part of some of these armed groups in Israel. And so I have this whole settler colonial past connected to my own family. And so Tilly, in some ways, I got some questions from some folks who read my book who just didn't understand, how can you combine Tilly with Marxism? And I think Tilly has a lot to teach us about understanding tactics and strategies. And for any social movement, I really think the fundamental factors are tactics, strategies, and objectives. And Tilly is worth paying a lot of attention to because that was really his life's work, is understanding at least tactics and strategies.
Well, thanks for handling that mouthful of a question in the first place. Strategies, tactics, and objectives. It seems fair now to say that the first book laid the theoretical foundations for your more practical application of theory in the second book, where you are both editor and contributor. Your 2021 publication, as we said, from Pluto Press, Workers' Inquiry and Global Class Struggle, Strategies, Tactics, Objectives. The focus is on the analysis of class composition, as we've been talking about, and even though not all the studies take the same approach, the link is this workers' inquiry methodology. Can you tell us a little more? Hey, what is a workers' inquiry? Can you explain some of the background and some of the different approaches?
Yeah, so the way to think about a workers' inquiry is that it's the methodology for understanding the class composition. So class composition is the theory, and a workers' inquiry is the methodology. So a workers' inquiry is essentially the method by which workers study the organization of work and try to understand the situation that they find themselves at work. How is work organized? Who's doing what? How are workers fragmented and put into a hierarchy? What are the new management strategies that have been introduced? How is technology introduced into the workplace? What were previous means by which workers organized? Understanding the different subgroups among workers based on race and gender and ethnicity, different workers who are connected through family relations or shared language or origin, if they're immigrants. And so an inquiry is really that entire study of that group of workers, perhaps in a single workplace or across the entire firm or even a whole sector, to try to understand how workers are currently organized at work so that they can understand the current technical composition, how is work organized and imposed on them, so they can develop tactics and strategies to organize themselves and realize their objectives, whatever those might be. And so for this book, which grew out of that, the issue of the Journal of Labor and Society, I recruited a few other people to contribute to begin to do what Ed Emery, British independent scholar, called for in the 1990s. He called for no politics without inquiry. And he said, before we can really struggle, we really have to understand how capital is organized and how workers are disorganized. And he wasn't the first one. This methodology actually was the last thing that Marx actually wrote about. At the end of his life, he wrote a survey of 100 questions for French workers, and he published it in a French newspaper, and he asked many of these kinds of questions. He also asked about, you know, what's the quality of your housing and how many people are in your family, and right? So a lot of demographic questions, and he called it a workers' inquiry, and he asked workers to answer the questions and mail them to him. And sadly, he never received a response. But about six decades later, independently, a group of worker militants in France and another group didn't know each other existed in Italy, had taken up Marx's method of the workers' inquiry. And in their own workplaces and collaborating with factory workers, and then soon to be joined a little bit later by some Americans around C.L.R. James and Raya Dunevskaya and others in their group, they did inquiries to further the struggles of those workers in those industries. And it was forgotten for a few decades. It kind of passed away out of attention until the 90s, when a German group did an inquiry into call centers, and they effectively abandoned their project when they couldn't find any examples of workers struggling. But they left behind an incredible treasure of an inquiry, and that was discovered, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago by a group that still exists called Notes from Below, and they have a really rich website. I co-edited a few issues of their online magazine with them a few years back, and they kind of re-energized it and brought workers' inquiry back into prominence. And I remember first kind of tripping onto Notes from Below's website and discovered, oh my God, I'm not the only one who's working with class composition theory and workers' inquiry. And so that's kind of the genealogy of where it came from the pen of Marx and the mind of Marx.
Yeah, interesting. Nice connections there, and this idea of it being kind of resuscitated. You wrote a really thorough overview as an introduction, and you divide this book into three parts as well. And it's really roughly into industry sectors that are spread out geographically. Part one is concerning the transport and logistics with worker inquiries from Argentina, Turkey, and Italy. Part two, you move into education and then, as you mentioned, call centers, the so-called platform work and gamers with samples from or research from the U.S., Mexico, and the U.K. And then part three is about manufacturing and mining, more traditional sector from China, South Africa, and India. In chapter four, though, and I mentioned this a little while ago, you wrote about credible strike threats based on your own experience with the California State University system. There's a lot going on there, and I think there's some linkage with the call center situation where kind of an apathy that you couldn't, there wasn't really a struggle going on. So that's part of the issue, isn't it, where people disagree as to what's actually happening on the ground. Are we resisting something or are we not?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's one of the motivations for putting this book together is when we look around, we get the sense that things are getting worse. Work is getting worse. Pay is continuing to be extremely low. And maybe 40% of the U.S. labor force is precarious, part-time, contingent, without any long-term expectations of employment, unbenefited. And yet, below the surface, there is a lot of class conflict going on, not just in the United States, but in many parts of the world. Just in the last few months, we've seen general strikes in Colombia, in India, the world's largest general strike in history, the largest number of people, an estimated 100 million people went on strike. But we also see everyday small-scale struggles of what I call workers marching on the boss with a complaint. You know, we saw the failure to organize a union in Alabama, a poorly organized unionization effort. But on the same day that their failed vote was announced, workers in a Chicago Amazon warehouse walked out in a wildcat strike. Payday report documented in the first few months of the pandemic in the United States that there were about 600 wildcat strikes, whereas the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I haven't looked precisely, but I would say has said there haven't even been 600 strikes in the last two decades. I would make that about an estimate. So are workers organizing, or are they just letting the hammer fall on them and letting it fall where it may? And what I found in these different contributions, which you laid out very nicely around the world, is that whether workers have an official union or not, they're still attempting to organize to improve their lives, to get control over their work, and to improve their communities. And in some cases, like the chapter in the truck drivers in Argentina, they've actually taken over their union and democratized it and used it to find the weaknesses in the trucking sector so they could apply pressure there to be more successful in their organizing efforts. So I think the short of it is that there's an abundance of class conflict, of class struggle going on around the world. It's just that we tend to read reports that nothing's happening and things just keep getting worse. And I actually, to kind of bring it back to the beginning of our conversation, I actually decided that this is going to be where I'm going to put my focus because I'm looking at worker struggles because I really think that because we live in a global capitalist system, in order to solve the many threats to the survival of humanity and the many other species that we're going to take down with us, we really have to change our economic system. And the only way to really change it is to bring that system to a halt. And the only people who can do that are the 95% of us who are working for a wage or for a salary. And so the short answer to your question is, I think I see struggle happening all over the place.
With regard to what happened with Amazon in Bessemer, what's the takeaway there for people looking at that kind of activism and saying, well, gee, see, it really doesn't amount to much because you can't get people worked up to actually, you know, make a difference. And yet you point out almost simultaneously Chicago's erupting.
Yes. Well, I think Bessemer is a great example of what's wrong with the labor movement. And this kind of ties in with my chapter on my own union. But if we look at another book in the Wildcat, the Pluto Wildcat series by Wilson and Reese called The Costs of Free Shipping, they look at the global struggles, social movement and labor struggles to contest Amazon's growing power around the world. And what they show us in the book is that there's a different kind of labor organizing that's going on in Amazon that is much more effective than the now, I would say, futile method of using labor law to try to organize the workplaces, which is what the warehouse workers union attempted to do in Bessemer. Essentially, what that campaign in Bessemer was not really a union organizing effort. It was a representational effort. They needed to win a majority vote in order for the warehouse union to represent the workers in that workplace. And the reason why it failed so badly was they didn't really organize the workers. They tried to get workers to sign cards first to call for an election, and you only need a minority of workers to do that, and then to get a majority to vote in an election. And of course, you're going up against the world's biggest corporation, and they don't want a union, even in a single warehouse. So they went into that fight essentially with their hands tied behind their back, and in some ways, consciously so, because they knew they were going up against the world's most powerful corporation. But yet, workers are still finding ways to self-organize. You know, right now, I'm in touch with a network of Amazon workers who joined one of our Pluto Wildcat series, How We Organize, webinars back last fall. We had Amazon workers from 5 countries all talking about the tactics and strategies they're using to self-organize. And so I think the takeaway lesson really for those who are interested in these issues is a union is not the institution. A union can be found anywhere where a group of workers are cooperating with each other to try to make their working conditions and lives better. That's what a union is. And I really hope to recapture the original meaning of union, which is exactly that, a group of workers who are organizing with each other. A union is not just an institution that has dues-paying members and has a contract.
Was that your finding as well with regard to California Faculty Association and back in, what was it, 2012, 16. I think, to 2016? Okay.
Yeah, there was a previous strike. There was a strike a few years earlier. It's not exactly the same thing. With that, what I was trying to do was look at another way that I think we're starting to see class conflict emerging in the United States and becoming more prevalent, and that is in the form of threatening to strike. So workers who have a contract that's expiring or workers who have demands and are being ignored will make a threat to strike if they're not being heard and they don't get some concessions. And it happens in different ways. And I got a small research grant and with a research assistant, we tried to count how many strike threats had there been over a 5-year period. And we found that the number of strike threats that didn't result in a strike because they were settled or they gave up and decided not to strike or whatever reason, over 2012 to 16 was about 37% higher than the number of actual strikes counted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and twice as many workers were involved in collective action of preparing for a strike threat. And because my union, I was involved in organizing for our called strike that didn't happen, so it became a strike threat that was settled. I wanted to try to understand how does a strike threat prove that it's credible? And so I looked at our own strike threat, and I found that it wasn't very credible. And I wasn't surprised, because what we got out of the strike threat, which we called off about a day or so before we were supposed to strike, wasn't very impressive.
Trying to put that together with collective bargaining agreements and, say, not necessarily the futility of labor law, but that overstates it. Your point there is you've got a union. It's not your point about people organizing with or without the organizational structure of a union. That's kind of a separate issue from established unions that, say, are more responsive. But I was also thought there was a bit of tension there with regard to union, was it like union contractism or union contracts and CBAs? And
yes. So one of the reasons for, I think that's a great point. One of the reasons that we've seen a decline in the number of union members in the United States and many countries around the world, I think China's the one exception because there's only one union and, you know, most workers are in it if, you know, the state and the employer want them in it. And then the decline in the number of strikes and strike-related activities is not just the way that the BLS mismeasures that, but it really has to do with changes in labor law. So during the Great Depression, one of the laws that was passed as part of the New Deal is called the Wagner Act. And while the Wagner Act is both something that we admire, but we also despise. It was the first legal protection for workers to form a union and to bargain and to strike. And it obligated employers to meet and negotiate with their workers. However, over the last, where are we now, about 9 decades, labor law has been increasingly transformed into, I call it a harness on workers organizing. The failure in Bessemer is a failure of thinking. The warehouse union went into that thinking, we want to organize workers in Amazon, and we're going to use the rules of labor law to do it. Well, that law is really stacked against workers. And so it's almost impossible today to actually form a union that the employer is forced to recognize. And if they do recognize them, it can take several years before a contract is negotiated. But even if a contract, let's say in those rare cases where a new contract is negotiated for the first time, the contract itself then becomes a break on workers organizing for various reasons. First, it's a legally binding contract. Workers can't take certain kinds of collective action until the contract expires if they're under federal labor law. If they're under state labor law and they're public employees in their state, there are all kinds of limits and restrictions on what they can bargain over, and then also whether or not they can even strike. Also, contracts can have all kinds of limits. For example, I've taught at a community college where our contract prohibited us from striking. In other words, we waived the most powerful tool that we have in order to get that contract. And it wasn't a very well-paying community college, I should say. So it wasn't a great contract. So there are all kinds of legal and contractual limitations on the ability of workers to organize, even when they have a contract. But there's another level to it, too, is that the union then becomes an institution that exists for the purpose of collecting dues and negotiating the contract. And that's what I call contract unionism. I borrow this term from Manny Ness. And that's where unions exist primarily to negotiate a contract. So over the last 50 years, many unions have forgotten how to organize because they're so focused on the legal aspect of being a union, which is filing and protecting workers in the grievance process and in negotiating contracts, that they've forgotten that workers have power by being organized. And so the union movement has declined dramatically. And even where workers are organized, they often have to make terrible concessions in order to keep their jobs and renew their contract. And we are seeing some long strikes going on in the United States right now. Alabama miners, hospital workers in Pennsylvania have been out on strike for months because the employer can just say, hey, we're not going to negotiate a new contract with you. Take it or leave it. And that's the only time when you can actually strike is when essentially both parties can't come to an agreement, then under federal labor law and most state labor law, that's when you can actually strike. And sometimes that's a year or two after your contract expires. So I'm sorry about the long explanation, but the reality of it is that workers who organize using labor law are finding that they're losing the power that they have in the workplace.
Would you still agree, though, that the power of the working class lies in their ability to withhold their labor, that really is their weapon, in a sense, the strike?
Ultimately, yes. And what labor law does is it makes it impossible or even illegal to actually use that weapon. So it's like if we go back to Charles Tilly and Charles Tilly's tactical repertoire, when Tilly looked at workers going on strike, he saw the strike as one of the highest levels of intensity in the repertoire. It's like you go to the strike when everything else fails, right? Mm. And so the problem is now we can't even get to that tactic in the repertoire. We can do everything else short of the strike, and everything else is not sufficient.
Sure.
And so workers find themselves in a worsening situation.
A Columbia University law professor, Katerina Pistor, wrote a book called Code of Capital. In it, she said, and I mentioned it just as an overlap for those interested, that realizing the centrality and the power of law for coding capital has important implications for understanding the political economy of capitalism, because it shifts attention from class identity and class struggle to the question of who has access to and control over the legal code, which is, I think, what you were talking about there.
Mm-hmm. You know? I'm writing a book, my fourth book. I'm co-writing it with someone, and she told me about this book, and I'm glad you brought it up. It's exactly the point that I make about labor law. Is that employers and the state have been able to transform labor law from a shield to a sword and use it essentially to decompose the power of workers.
Well, I was going to ask you what you were currently working on. I think at the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned institutional law.
Yeah, so I have contracts for two books right now. The book that I'm writing right now is Class Analysis of the U.S. Constitution. So I'm looking at how the Constitution was designed to have built into it numerous areas where a numerical minority can block change from happening in order to dampen and put the brakes on political democracy and prevent economic democracy from happening. And then the book after that, I'll be co-writing it with Divya Sundar, and we're writing about non-governmental organizations and nonprofits and how they've emerged, particularly in the post-World War II era. We're going to be looking at them globally and in the United States, and essentially as a kind of alternative institution to kind of redirect and absorb a lot of the energy of social movements and worker organizing.
Well, look forward to those, Robert. Hopefully you can share more of your thoughts with me on NBN in the future in relation to those. You know, the first one that you mentioned, it made me think of the Howard Zinn comment that political rights are meaningless without economic rights.
Yes.
And it sounds like you're going after that in a good way. As a final question for you, I've taken up a lot of your time. Do you have any reading recommendations? You've given some already that you'd make to listeners as students of the labor movement and activism, looking to complement and enhance their understanding of your books and the need for change?
Yeah. So if you're looking to try to delve into the history of class conflict in the United States, I can't recommend strongly enough Jeremy Brecher's Strike, which I think just reached its 50th anniversary and is back in print. It's had several editions. You mentioned Howard Zinn, People's History of the United States, I think a great place to start. And a lot of people don't realize there's a graphic novel version of it. So I think that book's like 700 pages long. And so the graphic novel version is really fun to read. And then also I would take a look at some of the books coming out of the Pluto Wildcat series, you know, to plug that series. I think there's some sure. fantastic books there. But I think we're living in an incredible time right now of just a plethora of incredible work that's happening. And happening in a lot of different areas around understanding capitalism. You know, I'm looking for a book right now to read about climate catastrophe. And I've just discovered that in the last year or two, there are several books connecting capitalism and the climate. And so I think there's a lot of really good work. We're really starting to look at this economic system. So in terms of also other specifics around global class conflict, I would encourage folks to take a look at the Notes from Below website. There's a lot of great issues in there. And if you're interested in worker self-organizing, Callum Kant's book, Riding for Deliveroo, which is a European ride-hailing, not ride-hailing, but sorry, a platform food delivery company. Really great book about how these food delivery workers riding bicycles organize their own autonomous union. A really great book-length study of that. So I don't know if if you want me to keep going.
No, I get that, and sure, there's a lot out there, and no, I appreciate your recommendations, Robert, and congratulations on your recent books. Look forward to the new ones. But the recent books, again, When Workers Shot Back: Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. Hey, it's a big book, but it's well worth the read and a look at your analysis. And then you also edit, and you're a contributor to the 2021 publication from Pluto Press entitled Workers' Inquiry and Global Class Struggle, Strategies, Tactics, and Objectives. Hey, the two go together nicely, and maybe just end it there and just say this. Robert, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Keith, for having me. It's been great talking to you.